gut stuff might be uncomfortable for you to talk about, but it's even more uncomfortable for you to deal with. And you have better things to do this year. Don't let your gut get in the way of that. Kick off the year of the habit and get science-backed digestive support during Ritual's New Year's sale. Their 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic help support a balanced gut microbiome. The delayed release capsule is designed to help reach the colon where probiotics can actually survive and grow, so you can focus less on your gut and more on sharpening your salsa dancing skills or whatever your 2026 goals are. Start a habit that sticks with 40% off your first month, plus a free gift with purchase at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Dirty hands means clean theology. Can you dig it?
What is going on, local guys and local gals? And hey, we've not forgot about those long-distance pals.
We're back.
And no cheeky grin or cracking up. It's finally settled.
I've held it together. I know it. It's only taken 4 years, but
I've been listening to some of the old stuff, and yeah, every time you cracking up, like I'll never get used to that.
It was always funny, but it's catchy. You even had that guy write in, and didn't he have like that play the original music and everything for the intro that went along with it and whatnot? That was pretty cool.
Yeah, and Roger. Roger Wyrick, he actually done the shout out to Roger, but he actually done the music for the Prometheus lens.
Oh, awesome!
Yeah,
that's nuts. Well, here's to you, Roger.
Yeah.
As of right now, we've kind of just been in a holding pattern. Me and you did get to go out and see a couple of mounds a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
We went up to West Virginia. And that was pretty cool, but at the same time, it's a little sad. That's the one thing I can't shake.
Yeah, the industrial complex there.
They had a
sports complex.
Entire sports complex around a mound that isn't even listed, or it doesn't have a sign anywhere around it. It just looks like a mound of dirt, but it's right next to a base or a swimming pool. It's right next to the swimming pool and
soccer fields
and. You wouldn't know anything that's there.
No. It's a multi-million-dollar facility. I mean, we're talking like there was like 4 soccer fields, a huge pool right beside of it. It was like 2 football fields and then like that big stadium.
Yeah, it was huge. And they all had, they all had scoreboards. I mean, the place was huge.
Yeah.
But then you get to that mound. And there's not even a sign to commemorate the fact. And that was the Shawnee Burial Mound, I think, is what it was called, which it's sad to me. And it's right next to the dumpsters.
Yeah, they got 2 big dumpsters right at the base of it.
And that just is sad to me. You sit there and you think about the history that's there, that somebody is buried there, some buddies. Man, it's just sad to see that they're not respected in that way. And I mean,
not even the historical, you know, remembrance, you know, of it, you know, because I know some people will be like, if it's giants in there, it's Nephilim, so who cares if there's a dumpster there? But still, I mean, there's no signage or anything, you know. It's like you said, I mean, especially the younger generation that's going there playing soccer and swimming, and there's a pile of dirt.
Yeah, it was to me, it's just sad to see, because I think this is why when we can look back and say, okay, the flood was, you know, whatever, 4,000 years ago. And if we say the world's, you know, 6,000 years old, depending on your, if you're young or old, you know, old creationist. But if we say that the flood was approximately, was that 4,400 years ago, something to that effect is what most people agree on. How easy is it for history to be forgotten, for us to totally believe a different narrative when we aren't even going to respect or remember what's in our own backyard right now that's a lot newer?
Yeah, a couple hundred years. Yeah.
And that just really, I think that's part of the big deception in the world today is that, and one that's meant to make people kind of forget who God is let's forget about the past. Let's focus on the future and what we as men have done, not what God has done. And I think that's a big thing. And I think that's why we see so many things historically forgotten in less than a generation.
Yep.
But it's sad to me because history often repeats itself.
Yeah.
Nothing new's under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So, but.
Yep. And you keep repeating the same mistakes. You know, what was it? That one guy, Emerson, he said, how did he word it? He said, something about stupid repetitiveness is the hobgoblin of the little mind.
Yeah, it was or the other one, always repeating the same thing, expecting a different outcome is the definition of insanity.
Mm-hmm. Foolish consistencies, that's what he
foolish
said.
Foolish consistencies.
Foolish
like
consistencies
that.
Is no, the hobgoblin like that, of the little mind.
Well, I'll tell you. But it's always cool to go on those trips, though, to view those things, to see that history. And in turn, what you're trying to do with that is trying to put together a documentary on that. But at the same time, it's another way that we can preserve history. And I think that's really important that we see that, we preserve history. And we're in a day and time when we have video and things like this, where a few hundred years ago, obviously, you don't have that luxury. So we have video. We have these things now. We can save this and we can save that history so that people, you know, generations after us can still look back and see that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big thing. I think that's why it's really important right now for people like Justin, people like me to be out there and looking for those things. I think it's, there's a lot of people out there and a lot of people who listen to shows like the Prometheus Lens or even the Dig that love looking into those things. And if you guys know anything out there that you'd like us to take a look at that's like that along those lines, please reach out to either Justin at the Prometheus Lens or reach out to the Dig email, which I think
the Dig 423.
It's the Dig 423 at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the Prometheus Lens?
Yeah, it's I think it's Prometheus Lens 423.
At gmail.com.
Yeah.
So reach out, let us know if there's any cool places we can go film that you guys think are of historical importance and that just kind of lead us back to, you know, the truth of who God is as well. And all these things, even, you know, we say that, but these burial mounds and these historical places, in the end, they still point us back to who God is. These people are there. They're buried for a reason. There's all sorts of religious and ritualistic things that go along with those, but we can see throughout that whether or not that was in, you know, for God is in the capital G, but it was potentially for some of those smaller case G gods as well, where people are sacrificed or all these different things happened, and these ritualistic, the other one we went to had a very unique, there was a large individual in the bottom with 11 kind of in a rainbow shape around that person.
Yeah, spokeswheel burials.
And so there's a ritualistic, there's a part of this that is very religious. Whether or not it's obviously it's pagan in most instances, but when we see these things, it just helps us. We don't want to forget where we came from. We don't want to forget the things that humanity's been through because that puts us right back into that position again.
Yeah. Well, that little small town, what was it, South Columbia?
South Charleston.
South Charleston in West Virginia. They're not going to forget because they built their entire town around it. It's the centerpiece.
How many people walk by and have no clue?
Oh, yeah. I'd say there's a lot.
I mean, they have signage there. They did a good job. They have these two little cool staircases that kind of go up in a...
like a spiral. A
conical spiral way up the mound, which is cool. And that's a little bit bigger mound. It's nothing like Miamisburg or places like that, but it's still substantial. But it literally is. You get up to the top, and you look down to the bottom, and right at the bottom is the Mound Laundry Cleaners.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was pretty funny. But
yep. And beside it's the Dollar General, and then across the street is the Tobacco Barn.
The Tobacco Barn. Well... yeah, like I said, reach out to us if you guys have anything that you think would interest us on that front.
We love field trips.
Love field trips. But today, we're moving on and continuing with our Bible study in Genesis. We've gone through all of Abraham, you know, all of from the beginning, from Adam all the way through Abraham, and we're right now with Isaac and Jacob and Esau. And we're starting in chapter 26.
Mm-hmm.
A severe famine now struck the land, as has happened before in Abraham's time. So Isaac moved to Gerar, where Abimelech, king of the Philistines, lived. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt, but do as I tell you. Live here as a foreigner in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. I hereby confirm that I will give all these lands to you and your descendants, just as I solemnly promised Abraham, your father. I will cause your descendants to become as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give them all of these lands. And through your descendants, all nations of earth will be blessed. I will do this because Abraham listened to me and obeyed all my requirements, commands, decrees, and instructions." So Isaac stayed in Gerar. When the men who lived there asked Isaac about his wife, Rebekah, he said, "She is my sister." He was afraid to say, "She is my wife," he thought. "They will kill me to get to her because she is so beautiful." But sometime later, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out his window and saw Isaac caressing Rebekah. Immediately, Abimelech called for Isaac and exclaimed, "She is obviously your wife. Why did you say she is my sister?" "Because I was afraid someone would kill me to get her from me," Isaac replied. "How could you do this to us?" Abimelech exclaimed. "One of my people might have easily taken your wife and slept with her, and you would have made us guilty of a great sin." Then Abimelech issued a public proclamation: "Anyone who touches this man or his wife will be put to death." When Isaac planted his crops that year, he harvested 100 times more grain than he planted, for the Lord had blessed him. He became a very rich man, and his wealth continued to grow. He acquired so many flocks of sheep and goats, herds of cattle, and servants that the Philistines became jealous of him. So the Philistines filled up all of Isaac's wells with dirt. These were the wells that had been dug by the servants of his father Abraham. Finally, Abimelech ordered Isaac to leave the country. "Go somewhere else," he said, for you have become too powerful for us." So Isaac moved away to the valley of Gerar, where he set up their tents and settled down. He reopened the wells that his father had dug, which the Philistines had filled in after Abraham's death. Isaac also restored the names of Abraham had given them. Isaac's servants also dug in the Gerar Valley and discovered a well of fresh water. But then the shepherds from Gerar came and claimed the spring. "This is our water," they said, and they argued over it with Isaac's herdsmen. So Isaac named the well Esek, which means argument. Isaac's men then dug another well, but again there was a dispute over it. So Isaac named it Sitna, which means hostility. Abandoning that one, Isaac moved on and dug another well. This time there was no dispute over it, so Isaac named the place Reboth, which means open space, for he said, "At last the Lord has created enough space for us to prosper in this land." From there, Isaac moved to Beersheba, where the Lord appeared to him on the night of his arrival. "I am the God of your father Abraham," he said. "Do not be afraid, for I am with you and will bless you. I will multiply your descendants, and they will become a great nation. I will do this because of my promise to Abraham, my servant." Then Isaac built an altar there and worshiped to the Lord. He set up his camp at that place, and his servants dug another well. One day, King Abimelech came from Gerar with his advisor, Ahuzath, and also Phicol, his army commander. "Why have you come here?" Isaac asked. "You obviously hate me since you kicked me off your land." They replied, "We can plainly see that the Lord is with you, so we want to enter into a sworn treaty with you. Let's make a covenant. Swear that you will not harm us, just as we have never troubled you. We have always treated you well, and we sent you away from us in peace. Now look how the Lord has blessed you." So Isaac prepared a covenant feast to celebrate the treaty, and they ate and drank together. Early the next morning, they each took a solemn oath not to interfere with each other. Then Isaac sent them home again, and they left him in peace. That very day, Isaac's servants came and told him about a new well they had dug. "We have found water," they exclaimed. So Isaac named the well Sheba, which means oath. And to this day, the town that grew up there is called Beersheba, which means the well of the oath. At the age of 40, Esau married two Hittite wives, Judith, the daughter of Beri, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon. But Esau's wives made life miserable for Isaac and Rebekah. And that's the end of chapter 26. Well, I think a couple things right off the bat is we see Abimelech, who we saw Abimelech with Abraham, and we see Phicol a little later in the chapter, who is the commander of the army, who also was the commander of the army when Abraham was there. This is about 70 years later.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same Abimelech. It's not the same Phicol. Most people believe that at that time that, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but Abimelech was a name given to the Philistine king in that Gerar region. And Phicol was the name given to, it's like calling you commander. So he's the commander of the army. That's Phicol. That's what it is. And when I say Phicol, P-H-I-C-O-L. So, but it's the name that were given to the people in those posts. Because it's hard to believe that someone who was an army commander at, even if he was young, even if he was 25 or 30, that 70 years later at 100 years old, he's still the army commander.
Yeah.
It just didn't work that way. And most kings in their lineage, if we look through, say, the Book of Kings, most of those kings of the Israelites or in Judah lasted like anywhere from 6 months to 6 years, and then somebody either assassinate him or they died from something. So most of the time a king doesn't rule for 70 plus years. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting just to see those little, that little context. The other interesting thing I saw at the beginning here is when it says that, the king looked out his window and saw him it in the NLT, it says caressing his wife. The word that's actually used is the verb. The direct translation is playing with his wife, and
like sexual play.
It either means fondling or some sort of sexual act. So
the fact was something that only a husband would do with his wife,
which is how he knew. It wasn't like caressing her arm, because, I mean, you could go up and comfort your sister.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he was doing something to make it very blatant that it was
not
his wife.
His sister.
Yeah. Or the king, you know, first said, what in the... Oh, no. You know, but it's just one of those things where the context makes a big difference when you read those things.
Mm-hmm. And I got it highlighted here. I know the translations are always a little different, but verse 4... that promise is the same promise given to Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, in mine, it says, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. I got a little note in there about, you know, could this be referring to quality as not so much quantity? You know, I'm going to make you as the stars of heaven, like Job and so many other passages, the heavenly beings are compared to stars. the sons of God. So therefore, it's like a covenant promise, you know, of what's to come, that we will go back to a Garden of Eden style atmosphere and be sons of God like Adam was, because Adam was listed as a B'nai HaElohim, and that is our promise to become, you know, grafted into the family of God, a B'nai HaElohim. So we will be as the stars.
And the same, and in the same way, basically taking the Abrahamic covenant, making it now the Isaiah covenant, it says the same thing that it said before, which is really important to us. It says that through them, all earth, all the nations of the earth will be blessed.
Yeah.
Which is, it's funny because throughout the Old Testament, you know, we always fixate on Israel. We fixate on Israel, 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 Israel. When really even the covenant from the beginning is talking about everybody. Everybody's going to be blessed through them. They're just the vessel God's choosing to use.
Yeah, reversing Babel.
Exactly. One other thing I was going to say on the Isaac and Rebecca thing when they're on the roof. Rashi, and that's something that I know you like talking about Rashi a little bit, but Rashi talks about that where he says the phrasing that's used basically says that Isaac kind of got complacent while he was there, which in turn led to him being a little more physical with his wife. And in turn, that's how this whole thing came about. But he talks about how Isaac had basically become comfortable, had become complacent in where they were living in that place. So this could have been over a long period of time.
Yeah.
This could have been.
Well, yeah, it was long enough for them to gain social status and wealth and all this kind of stuff, because they ended up running him off, you know, because of it.
Yeah, I just, it's pretty amazing. You know, you read it sometimes and you're like, well, this happened, and then yes, the next day this happened, and the next day this happened, and that's not how it works. So
And then at the end it mentions the Esau marrying the Hittites and Hivites, known Nephilim giant clans, and it talks about how they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah, because I think it was Rashi in his writings. And also, I remember in Ginsberg, Legends of the Jews, it talked about, you know, they were pagan, you know, deity worshipers. So they brought their gods with them and their culture. And so where they were trying to live together in these family units or whatever, it was causing a lot of strife in the home, differences of religion and opinions, and the women were clashing.
Yeah. And that's funny you say that. It says there Isaac, or I'm sorry, it says Isaac and Rebecca gave them much grief, but as we see later, maybe the women did, but Isaac preferred Esau, and that's actually one of those things where we talked about that with his cooking and things of that nature. Being his firstborn, he, you know, had a preference for Esau. Not saying you should do that. I'm just saying he did. If we go back a little further, I thought it was kind of interesting. We're going to back it up. When the water rite stuff happens, I always think, you know, when we see different numbers in the Bible, that a lot of things are symbolic, or they lead us to something different. But we see numbers like 7, you know, like 40, 70. We see those all the time. But one of the most important numbers in the whole Bible is 3. And if we go back, we look at the wells. Mm-hmm. First well, nope, doesn't work. Second well, nope, they're going to come and take that one over too. Third time's a charm. Where does that phrase come from? That idiom that we use all the time. Mm-hmm. Third time's a charm. And that comes from, I think, probably a longstanding history of things like that happening. We see 3 always repeating as a number of, you know, wholeness of who God is.
Validation stamp, you know.
It is. It's it. Yep. And so what happens on the third one, boom, it's good. So you can look at it in a lot of ways. You could look at it in the way Jesus died, you know, and maybe a foreshadowing. You know, he's in the ground or in the tomb On the third day he rises. Mm-hmm. So we see the first 2 days, negative things. Everybody's down. Everybody's, you know, tore up. These things are happening. You know, Satan and his angels think they won. Third day, guess what? Everything good happens. Mm-hmm. So
the sign of Jonah.
I love it. Another cool thing a little bit. I said the other cool thing a lot. When Abimelech ran him out of town, and I mean, he said in peace is what he said, but he asked him to leave because he said, you're too powerful for us. He was scared of him.
Yeah.
And then he comes back to him to say, even though he's gone now, he left peacefully. He comes back to him and says, you want to sign a treaty? Like, can we just make sure we're on good terms?
Yeah, because he's like, I don't want no resentment build up, you know, where I kind of, you know, pushed you out, you know. I don't want you sitting out here at the edge of the, you know, the desert plotting your revenge.
But I think it's so cool because they see God. They see how powerful God is because they see in how he's blessed Isaac and how Isaac has everything he needs and then some. I mean, can you imagine somebody going out there and it says he got 100 times more than he planted. So you go out there and plant 10 stalks of corn and you get 1,000 ears or something. It just, you think about it like that doesn't, I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. I'm sorry, 100, but it's crazy when you think about it, they'd see this and they looked at him and just say, no matter what he does, he can do no wrong.
Got the Midas touch.
The Midas touch. And so they see that and they see who God is. So God's even witnessing to these other nations, the same way we talked about earlier. But these other nations can see God. They see him in everything. And just like when the Israelites left Egypt, a lot of Egyptians went with them. They left with them. So it wasn't just, you know, the Israelites left. They're like, nope, we saw the power of your God. We're going with you. Like, we know what's happening. Like, we're good with this Egyptian God stuff isn't working. You know, Hapi is not protecting the Nile. Yeah. It just isn't happening. So they come with and leave with. And that's why there's so many things and so many different rules about how the foreigners that live among them need to follow their customs, need to follow the Israelites' ways, need to follow the law and all the different things at that time. They needed to follow in line to still be part of that culture. But God didn't deny anybody from coming in. He just said, you have to be like my people.
Mm-hmm.
So even from the beginning, he was letting people in. I just think that's kind of another cool connection.
Yep. It explains, too, why the golden calf, you know, Hathor, Egypt.
Mm-hmm. So cool thing, and Derek Gilbert talked about this, and that's why I think it's...
it's gold. Derek said it. It's gold.
It's gold. But when they leave Egypt, I know that we're kind of on a little bit of a rabbit trail here off this, but when they leave Egypt, when Pharaoh finally lets them go, people of Israel are wandering across the desert but going towards the Red Sea, and they kind of get bottlenecked between where the mountain where the altar to Baal's Zephon is and the Red Sea, which is represented by the god Set. So the Egyptians see the Israelites between two of their most powerful deities saying, yeah, their god did all these things, but now guess what? Our gods are delivering them back to us. We have them.
Mm-hmm.
And then God said, nope. Opens the Red Sea. They walk through on dry ground, and then their mighty god Set wasn't able to protect them when the waves came crashing down. But just a cool connection that I always love that. Yep. How you see how God makes, and it says specifically in Exodus how God will make war against the gods of Egypt, not the people of Egypt. It was the gods of Egypt he made war against, which is why each plague referred to a certain god. And we did that. We did a whole episode on that back probably in the first season, second season. I don't remember. It's been a while, but it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love how he had him turn to Baal Zephon, you know, and that was, you know, the storm god. And I kind of joked in that episode. I said, it's kind of like he was telling, oh, you're the storm god, huh? well, here, hold my beer and watch this.
It's just amazing how when you have faith, even when things are really dark, even when things are really bleak, even when you think it's the very end, God always finds a way to help you through. And I think that's a constant story in the Bible. I mean, over and over and over again, how many times did Abraham face, you know, adversity? You know, you can go down, how many times Isaac and then Jacob, I mean, how many times he faced adversity? You go through and Joseph, go back to the beginning, Moses. I mean, what did he go through? And man, those guys, every time, there's tons of times where they think, this is it. Or man, I got to tell them that's my sister, otherwise they're going to kill me. They just didn't have faith. But if they do, man, God always finds a way to help you through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a, it's such a cool lesson that the Bible shows us in almost every book, in almost every chapter. You can kind of see how, if you follow God, even when times are tough, things will get better.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is, hold on. You didn't do your thing like you used to do.
Oh yeah. Shoot the rabbit.
Shoot the rabbit. We went down that rabbit trail a little too far, but we jumped into the whole next book of the Bible. That is my bad.
Beep, beep, beep.
We're going to back it up into Genesis. You got anything on 26? Anything else?
Nope.
Well, we are going to jump into chapter 27. This is a pretty famous story that a lot of people will, even if you are fairly new to the biblical scene, will have heard this story before, but there's some cool nuances and some things that we'll see as we read through. But chapter 27. One day when Isaac was old and turning blind, he called for Esau, his older son, and said, "My son." "Yes, father," Esau replied. "I am an old man now," Isaac said, "and I don't know when I may die. Take your bow and quiver full of arrows and go out into the open country and hunt some wild game for me. Prepare my favorite dish and bring it here for me to eat. Then I will pronounce the blessing that belongs to you, my firstborn, before I die." But Rebekah overheard what Isaac had said to his son Esau. So when Esau left to hunt for wild game, she said to her son Jacob, "Listen, I overheard your father say to Esau, 'Bring me some wild game and prepare me a delicious meal. Then I will bless you in the Lord's presence before I die. Now, my son, listen to me. Do exactly as I tell you. Go out to the flocks and bring me 2 fine young goats. I will use them to prepare your father's favorite dish. Then take the food to your father so he can eat it and bless you before he dies." "But look," Jacob replied to Rebekah, "my brother Esau is a hairy man, and my skin is smooth. What if my father touches me? He'll see that I am trying to trick him. Then he'll curse me instead of blessing me." But his mother replied, "Then let the curse fall on me, my son. Just do what I tell you. Go out and get the goats for me." So Jacob went out and got the young goats for his mother. Rebekah took them and prepared a delicious meal the way Isaac liked it. Then she took Esau's favorite clothes, which were in the house, and gave them to her younger son Jacob. She covered his arms and the smooth parts of his neck with the skin of young goats. Then she gave Jacob the delicious meal, including freshly baked bread. So Jacob took the food to his father. "My father," he said. "Yes, my son," Isaac answered. "Who are you, Esau or Jacob?" Jacob replied, "It's Esau, your firstborn son. I have done as you've told me. Here is the wild game. Now sit up and eat so that you may give me your blessing." Isaac asked, "How did you find it so quickly, my son?" "The Lord your God put it in my path," Jacob replied. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come closer so I can touch you and make sure that you are really Esau." So Jacob went closer to his father, and Isaac touched him. "The voice is Jacob's, but the hands are Esau's," Isaac said. But he did not recognize Jacob because Jacob's hands felt hairy just like Esau's. So Isaac prepared to bless Jacob. "But are you really my son Esau?" he asked. "Yes, I am," Jacob replied. Then Isaac said, "Now, my son, bring me the wild game. Let me eat it, and then I will give you my blessing." So Jacob took the food to his father Isaac and ate it. He also drank the wine that Jacob served him. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come a little closer and kiss me, my son." So Jacob went over and kissed him. And when Isaac caught the smell of the clothes, he was finally convinced. And he blessed his son and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of the outdoors, which the Lord has blessed. From the dew of heaven and the richness of earth, may God always give you abundant harvests of grain and bountiful new wine, and many new nations become your servants. And may they bow down to you. May they be the master over your brothers. And may your mother's sons bow down to you. All who curse you will be cursed, and all who bless you will be blessed." As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and almost before Jacob had left his father, Esau returned from his hunt. Esau prepared a delicious meal and brought it to his father. Then he said, "Sit up, my father, and eat my wild game so you can give me your blessing." But Isaac asked him, "Who are you?" Esau replied, "It is your son, your firstborn Esau." Isaac began to tremble uncontrollably and said, "Then who just served me wild game? I have already eaten it. I blessed him before you came. And yes, the blessing must stand." Then Esau heard his father's words, and he let out a loud, bitter cry. "Oh, my father, what about me? Bless me too," he begged. But Isaac said, "Your brother was here, and he tricked me. He has taken away your blessing." Esau exclaimed, "No wonder his name is Jacob, for now he has cheated me twice. First he took my rights as the firstborn, and now he has stolen my blessing. Oh, haven't you saved even one blessing for me?" Isaac said to Esau, "I have made Jacob your master and declared that all his brothers will be his servants. I have guaranteed him an abundance of grain and wine. What is left for me to give you, my son?" Esau pleaded, "But do you only have one blessing? Oh, my father, bless me too." Then Esau broke down and wept. Finally, his father Isaac said to him, "You will live away from the richness of the earth and away from the dew of the heaven above. You will live by your sword and you will serve your brother. But when you decide to break free, you will shake his yoke from your neck." From that time on, Esau hated Jacob because their father had given Jacob the blessing. And Esau began to scheme, "I will soon be mourning my father's death. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." But Rebekah heard about Esau's plans. So she sent for Jacob and told him, "Listen, Esau is consoling himself by plotting to kill you. So listen carefully, my son. Get ready and flee to my brother Laban in Haran. Stay there with him until your brother cools off. When he calms down and forgets what you have done to him, I will send for you to come back. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am sick and tired of these local Hittite women. I would rather die than see Jacob marry one of them." And that's chapter 27.
Oof. Mm.
All right.
Lots of stuff there.
There is lots of stuff there.
A lot of that's stuff in my book, too.
See, I know. We did go over that a little bit a couple weeks ago. In the last, I don't know, I think it was the last one.
25.
It was 25.
You know, the birth of Esau.
And then we talked about the birthright. There's a little bit more here, which I think is kind of cool because it ties back into that again. Because God told Rebekah already that this was going to happen, basically. She told him that Jacob, the younger, would rule over the older.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was prepping her for this very moment. He was saying, "Hey, do everything in your power to make sure this happens." And that was her taking action to make sure that it happened.
And so, and it's funny, because if you think about it in a lot of different terms, first of all, God doesn't have to, God can do whatever he wants. He doesn't have to honor whatever, but he honors it because it's what's supposed to happen. And this is another instance where the younger has favor over the older. We see that in numerous biblical stories. You know, we could talk about even the prodigal son. We could talk about David. We could talk about a lot of different instances when the younger son is the one that is put more on a pedestal later on in their life. Joseph was a really good example of that as well, you know, being one of the youngers. But, and the other fact is that this isn't, you know, when we talk about a blessing, they're taking it very, this is not like a, just saying some words, this is just praying for you. This is something that they took very serious. This was something that truly meant something. This, something came out of this.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a will and testament, kind of like going to the lawyer's office, getting that stamp, that seal of approval. It's official now.
But it happens.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. God, so that blessing carries weight because God sees it through. And so that's how he said, even Isaac said, I can't take it back. Which I think it's kind of crazy. One little thing before we get into a little bit further is, I always struggled with the difference between a blessing and a birthright. You know, when I first would read this, I'm like, what, hold on, didn't he already get that? You know, didn't he trade a bowl of soup for that? Like, what's going on? But, and we might have talked about this when we did this last time. I'm not 100%, but I'm just going to say birthright would go to the oldest. It would make him basically the head of the household. He would inherit his father's estate, and he would receive a double portion of whatever was passed down. So that is what the birthright was, what was given, that what Esau traded Jacob. And we talked about that whole thing about why Esau would have done that. Go back and listen to that episode, because that sounds crazy that he would trade that for a bowl of soup, stew, red stuff, whatever you want to say. But it sounds crazy that he would do that. But if you go back and look at the context and the kind of the story that we laid out with some of the non-extra biblical sources, it's pretty interesting. But a blessing.
Yeah, he thought he was going to be king of the world. Hell with that birthright.
Yeah, well, he was actually about to die potentially.
Well, yeah.
But that was the blessing, it can go either way. But the greater blessing would always still go to the firstborn. But a blessing wasn't, you weren't limited, you know, in the same way. But obviously, it's able to stick to whoever you give it to, because we see that example right here.
And once again, it shows the favoritism of Isaac. He didn't reserve some little small blessing for even Jacob. He wanted it all to go to Esau, because he thought he was giving it to Esau. And he was like, there's nothing left to give. I've done gave it all to your brother. So, I mean, once again, it shows Isaac really favored Esau, because it was tradition, like you said, for the eldest to get the birthright. That was tradition. It was expected. But the blessing, you're going to give every single bit of it just to your eldest son? I mean, I think that kind of validates the favoritism of the father.
Well, and also he probably, I would imagine that the birthright thing did not go unnoticed. I'd imagine Isaac knew that Jacob at one point had taken that from Esau, and that he had traded that at one point in his life. I don't think that Isaac was oblivious to that. So maybe there was, maybe not so much that he favored Esau, but that almost despised Jacob.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I bet he felt sorry for him, because, I mean, if the extra biblical books, what we talked about, if that, you know, and I ain't going to spoil it, you got to go back and watch or listen to it or buy my book. But
or all of the above.
Yeah, but if that, in fact, happened, which I think it did, Jacob took advantage of a desperate man, a desperate dying man, and Isaac was like, that's dirty. I'm going to make sure that you don't get no blessing, because you're dirty, underhanded thing that you did to your brother.
Yeah, you have this part, I'm giving everything else to Esau.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting that way.
And then I make the claim in my book that he's what we would call today in our modern vernacular a Bigfoot, or what the ancients would have called maybe a feral giant. Growing up, I was always taught, oh, that's hyperbole. That's poetic language, his hair. Oh, he had a good thick beard. Well, right here, I mean, it says that they had to kill two goats and cover Jacob in it for the blind father to be tricked. So, I mean, no, this wasn't poetic language or hyperbole. He was literally that hairy. And anybody that's ever petted or touched a goat, I mean, that's not human. You're never going to mistake that for your hairy uncle's back, you know. I mean, that's thick, it's oily, it's coarse. I mean, it's beastly.
It reminds me of the Sumerian Enkidu.
Yeah, man.
It's the same correlation. A wild man covered in hair.
Yeah.
And fights almost to the death with Gilgamesh.
Mm-hmm.
Until they decide to team up a little later. But
and all those men were known as what? The Gibor hunters. Okay. The mighty hunters. All of them. Nimrod, Gilgamesh, Esau, and Enkidu.
So we see the correlations between the biblical text and the extra-biblical sources that I would argue, in a way that the whole reason we see the correlations, but they're slightly different, the names are different, and then the stories have been changed, and I would say through the telephone game, I'll say the biblical text remains true, but a lot of these other ones, they're modeled after that biblical text because at when we go way back, even to the Tower of Babel, right, everybody knew the core stories. And then everybody would kind of, you know, when that happened, all the languages separated out. And then people, as they went along, would find out, okay, we know about, we heard about this person and they basically culturally appropriate these different stories and turn them into their parts of lore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the biblical context is where you kind of see many of these things pulled from. And there's, I mean, the Epic of Gilgamesh and the Lord of Errata, you know, there's so many different things that point back to, like, that points back to Noah potentially, and all these different things where you see these other characters that point back to the biblical narrative, but you're seeing sub stories and sub context, and some of it may be true, some of it may not be. We don't know. There's a lot of stories and books out there, but a lot of it points back to maybe just a unique telling of a biblical story where they've took some poetic liberties.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Cultural lenses and contexts. And I make the argument in my book that the Epic of Gilgamesh, that section of Enkidu and Gilgamesh, is the Mesopotamian version or lens of the same story of Nimrod and Esau. Of course, you know, whoever's telling the tale is going to spin it to where their guy wins and their guy looks favorable. So that's where you get that perversion.
I think you're right. I think that's where a lot of that, as a matter of fact, if you go through most of it, even look back at the Egyptian monoliths and stuff that you see, they'll have, or was it Shalmaneser the third, the black obelisk? I think that's what it is that goes through, and they recount their victories. You don't see them carved into stone when they lose. Like, it just doesn't happen. So when you see these different things, it's talking about how great they are and the great things they've done. You don't see, well, you know, the God of Israel came and destroyed us. You know, you don't always see things like that. I'm not saying there isn't stuff out there, but most of the time what you see is the positive things. I think many of the earliest writings and some of the historical writings were probably burned up in the fire at Alexandria.
Yeah.
In the Great Library. And that to me is one of the saddest things, because so much of that stuff would have been so cool to know what was in those texts.
Yeah.
I mean, the story of the early world would have been in those texts. And once again, there'd have been a lot of pagan and other things that you'd have to sort through, but so many of the stories, so many things that had happened at that time would be very interesting to delve into.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing that I'd found, kind of like a repeating pattern, is fathers that have rebellious and sinful sons, and they don't act to try to correct or rebuke them, all without fail go blind in their older age. And I think it's kind of like I think it's a literal thing, but I think it's also like it's signaling that they were spiritually blind to the faults and flaws and sins of their children.
That is a really interesting point. I've never thought of before, but it kind of makes you think, in a grand scheme of things, we look at this world right now and we start culturally thinking that, you know, certain things that are biblically wrong, we're starting to accept, and a lot of those cultural norms now are accepted even by the church, and we're seeing the church become spiritually blind in the same way. We're saying that, yes, this is now no longer a sin. You know, this is okay. We accept these certain things that were considered sins at one time that biblically say they are sins. And now you're seeing that, man, the whole world as a whole is just so spiritually blind right now. I think that veil continues to get thicker and thicker over
many countries. And so do the lenses.
What's that?
The lenses continue to get thicker and thicker. But prescription lenses and contact prescriptions are on the rise.
I must have to talk to my sons a little more or something, because these glasses are getting pretty thick. But anywho, yeah, that's actually really interesting play. I think a lot of times God will do that, though. You get the physical attribute, but a lot of times there is a correlation, like a metaphorical correlation, where you see those things. And I think that's very true. I think our world right now in that same way, because we don't stand on our biblical principles anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That we're becoming more and more spiritually blind, and we are we lack insight into truly what's right and wrong. When you can have someone who says they're a Christian but yet I'm pro-abortion.
You ever read Dr. Seuss? Oxymoron.
I don't get it. Like, there's certain things that when you get to a point, when you really dive into those things, you're getting to a point where now you're rationalizing sin. We're rationalizing murder. We're rationalizing homosexuality. We're rationalizing transgender. We're rationalizing this. They say, oh, yeah. Jesus loved everybody. Come on in. And listen, Jesus wants you to be there. He wants you to be part of his church. But he still needs you to know that you're not supposed to be doing what you're doing. The whole point was you ask for forgiveness and you repent. When you repent, that means to turn around from whatever you're doing wrong.
Yeah. And the prodigal son had to get up out of the pig shit, wipe himself off, and come home.
He did.
The father didn't go after him. He had to clean his act up and come home.
That's something where we're called. God's not going to do it for us. We have to make a conscious choice. And that doesn't go. And that's when we're saying this, I'm not saying I'm any better than anybody else, because there's things I have to repent for. There's things that I have to say I'm sorry for. There's things that I screw up on a daily basis.
David and Paul, man, say no further. I mean, it's about the heart.
It is about the heart. And I think Sean always used that term, heart posture. What's your heart posture? Like, you know, are you standing in a loving way following after what God wants, or are you just being one way on the outside, but on the inside you're like, that son of a, you know, there's a God only. And that's why I think it says in the text so many times, you know, God knows your heart, right? There's a whole point is God truly knows what's in your heart. He knows who you are. He knows what you're about. He knows what you crave. He knows what you
ain't no fool in him.
No, there's no fool in him. He knows it all. But man, I think that's.
And we see the garments from the Garden of God in this little section here.
Oh well, go ahead. I know what you're talking about.
Yep. So, without spilling the beans, go back and listen to the other one when we talk about chapter 25, or get my book.
Shameless plug.
Yeah. But to dance around it, for those that are up to speed, remember the whole thing that Esau risked his life for, and this item that he hides in his house before he goes into the tent of his brother, and the whole deception and trading of the birthright. So he traded his entire birthright, risked his life for this item, and it was a garment. Spoiler alert.
You got to say the spoiler before you say it's a garment.
Oh, sorry.
Right.
Spoiler alert.
It's a garment.
It's a garment. Ancient aliens guy, I'm going to pull my hair out. I'm not saying it's a garment.
But it's a garment.
But it's a garment. But right here in verse 15, Rebecca, you know, gets the goat's fur, wraps him in it, and all this other kind of stuff, and it's kind of like the cherry on top for the deception. It says, then Rebecca took the best garments of Esau, her older son, and placed it upon her son, her younger son, Jacob. So not only did he, you know, almost lose his life, lost his birthright, the only thing he walked away with was these garments, and even those were stolen from him.
And kind of a crappy blessing.
Yeah. And what's amazing to me, too, is he was the mighty hunter, the person that he got these garments from was also a mighty hunter. And what happens? He's like, oh, I hear the voice of my son Jacob, but I feel my son Esau.
And smelled him.
That's what I was going to get to.
Sorry, I'm sorry.
And he says, but come closer. And he says, but you smell of the field. He had on those garments. The wild man. And all these Bigfoot stories. What do you hear? They talk about the smell. So, I mean, I thought that was pretty eye-opening when I read it with that kind of context and was studying that out. He was a Sasquatch.
I hope he's not the only one. I hope he's not the only one. If you have any Bigfoot stories, email us as well.
Yeah, we like all that weird
stuff. I love Bigfoot stories.
Yeah, you were the Bigfoot enthusiast, and I'm the one who ended up writing a book talking about it.
Yeah, I always loved Bigfoot stuff. Well, I did find one track once. But the one cool thing we got was at one of the conference a couple years ago at the conference in Brookville.
Oh, that scream, dude.
I actually found that yesterday because I was going through and deleting a bunch of stuff off my phone. I'm like, what is this?
Oh, play it over the mic. Let them hear it.
I'm going to see if you can hear this.
So this guy was a preacher, okay? He was like from Indiana, wasn't it, or something like that? But he came down to the conference and was talking to us about stuff. And he's like, oh, yeah, I was in the woods with my buddy. And we heard Bigfoot screaming at us. And it screamed 4 or 5 times. And I finally pulled my phone out and I got it on recording. You want to hear it? I was like, yeah.
Green Foster. Been filmed.
I'm out. Yeah, and he was a preacher. You know what I mean? I'm not saying preachers don't lie, but...
But I mean, I don't know.
It makes your hair stand up on the back of your neck. I mean, hearing it over this microphone, I'm sure it don't do it justice to hear it over the phone, and especially being in the woods and hearing it.
Yeah, and well, the thing is, that's recorded once and passed through I don't know how many different technological things when you're sending it through phones and texts and all this stuff. And then you're playing that version. It's broken down. It's just not as good, but it is pretty intense, even to hear it on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, I love this stuff. I love all the different connections that we see. I love just the word in general because there's so much you can pour over and pull from this. But I encourage you to get out your Bible, and as always,
keep digging
quietly.
Dig, baby, dig.